From the studios of EWTN, this is Open Line with today's host, Colin Donovan. In North America, call toll-free 1-833-288-EWTN. That's 1-833-288-3986. Outside North America, call 1-205-271-2985. You can also text the letters EWTN to 55000 or send an email to openline@ewtn.com.
833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number. 833-288-3986. Welcome to EWTN's Open Line Friday. Our very own Vice President of Theology, Colin Donovan, is in the house. If you've got a question for Colin, the number is, as I said, 833-288-EWTN. If you're outside the United States and Canada, we'd still love to have your call. That number is 1-205-271-2985, and we'll even put you straight to the front of the line at 1-205-271-2985. You can always send us an email, openline@ewtn.com. That's openline@ewtn.com. Or you can text your question to Colin, text the letters EWTN to 55000, wait for a response, text your first name and your question, message, and data rates may apply. I'm Jack Williams, straight from the skate park, Michael McCall producing the program today. I was going to tell you what t-shirt he had on, but I don't know if we have the rights to mention that brand, so I won't. I'm sure our skating fans can figure out what I'm talking about. Jeff Burson is handling our social media efforts and screening your phone calls today. So give us a call at 833-288-3986. And if you're watching us on YouTube or Facebook Live, you can type a question into the chat window and it may get to us by the end of the program. It was a gift. Okay, very good. Yeah, when I think of the International Man of Mystery, I think of skateboarding. And he was big in the half pipe, is my guess, very much. Yeah. There you go. Our host, as he is every single Friday, the one and only Colin Donovan. How are you?
You know, Jack, the disadvantage of not being in the studio is I only get about half of what you're saying to Mike.
Colin, you didn't have to tell people you weren't in the studio. You could have kept up the illusion of radio.
Well, we're all hoping that'll come to an end pretty soon here. Yeah. I hope that things are going to lighten up a little bit. And
I think so. I'm not sure that the powers that be at EWTN or the government officials in the state of Alabama or Jefferson County, I don't think that's our biggest hurdle. I think our biggest hurdle may be Andrea Donovan.
Well, there's probably a little bit of truth to that, but anyway, we'll cross those bridges when the time comes.
There you go. So, Colin, I want you to talk a little bit. I'm going to spring this on you without having spoken to you before. There was an article at the Catholic News Agency this morning, and I'm trying to be respectful without, you know, just slobbering my opinion all over everything. But the blurb that was pulled out was, you know, basically citing that the president, the head of the German Conference of Catholic Bishops, wanted to make it abundantly clear that the German bishops were not heading towards schism. And we've heard an awful lot about the blessing of same-sex couples and about communion for our non-Catholic brothers and sisters, the synodal way. Can you shed a little light for the average layperson as to just exactly what's going on over there?
Well, you know, I think Germany is a culture where obviously Catholics are in the minority, as they are in this country. The evangelical church, the Protestant church, what we call the Lutheran church in our own country, predominates there. And so the, you know, Reformed values with regard to divorce, with regard to the meaning of the Eucharist and the priesthood and the church and so on in general, are predominant. And I think what the bishops say they're trying to do, of course, is to, you know, accommodate in some way their culture without giving away the store. And that's the I think the basic nub of the question, whether that is even possible, because on many of the issues in which they accommodate, we're facing here in sort of more, you know, reduced fashion. So the intercommunion, in a Protestant conception of intercommunion, generally it's not understood in the same way as in the Catholic Church. It's fellowship, it's hospitality, it's the table of the Lord at which all are gathered. And this seems to be predominating in a lot of the language. Whereas in the Catholic view, the theological view is that when we receive Holy Communion, we receive Christ, and therefore we need to be worthy of receiving Christ. And that comes with many hurdles in the Catholic Church: baptism, introduction to the sacrament of First Communion, introduction to First Confession, so that where there is mortal sin, that can be confessed. And so a number of steps which would not be possible when you start talking about some kind of Eucharistic hospitality, or whether it's for spouses or the person who randomly shows up in the parish church, you know, because he's a non-Catholic friend of the family or something like this. And so the way the German bishops are going at it is with the synodal approach, they want to come to some national understanding of how to deal with this. Well, the difficulty with that is the Catholic Church is not a national church. It's a universal church. That's the meaning of Catholic. It has a hierarchical structure willed by Christ. It has a Eucharist which is valid in the sense that it truly is really and substantially the body and blood of Christ. So the very same things which might, for the sake of human accommodation and fellowship and hospitality, might be acceptable in a party situation or in a family gathering, are not necessarily acceptable within the church. And so the church's norms and rules have all has established ways in which, yes, in particular serious cases, canon law establishes people can receive communion who are not Catholic, and it gives some very strict criteria. These would not be observable in the kinds of circumstances that are being addressed in Germany. And so I think the parallel with our debate is whether politicians who are notably and publicly opposed to church teaching on serious matters and church practice with respect to the Eucharist, whether they ought to be admitted to the Eucharist. And the same values are there. If we believe it is Christ, if we believe that there are certain minimum conditions, which St. Paul himself speaks of in 1 Corinthians 11, you know, if you eat and drink unworthily, you eat and drink judgment to yourself. If we believe that, if we follow the universal laws of the church, which obliges every Catholic and even the bishops, then it doesn't seem possible. So the question of schism is raised. I would note that with schism, it means a disobedience. It means disobedience to hierarchical authority, typically the bishop, and more broadly, obviously, the pope. And so the question now going forward is, in their desire to meet these accommodations and have these accommodations, will they do so apart from the rest of the church, and particularly apart from communion with the Bishop of Rome? Now, privately, in the soul, in our standing before God, schism can be done without any external effect. People can be in schism, they can be heretics, they can be apostates without any, you know, ecclesiastical judgment or decision. So they can be in schism if they follow through on this, even though the Pope has said that this is not the way to go on these matters. But unless he issues a judgment against them, they would be in a de facto schism, but they would not be, you know, in overt schism or canonically in schism in that sense. So there's a lot at issue here, beginning with what is the true significance of the Eucharist for the Catholic that distinguishes, in our case, from every other ecclesial case or church that is out there.
833-288-EWTN. That's our toll-free number. It's a free phone call anywhere in North America. 833-288-3986. If you're outside the United States and Canada, your number is 1-205-271-2985. And we'll even put you straight to the front of the line at 1-205-271-2985. You can always send us an email, openline@ewtn.com. That's openline@ewtn.com. Plenty of open phone lines and plenty of time for your calls at 833-288-3986. It's Open Line Friday with Colin Donovan.
This is Open Line on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. If you have a question, call 1-833-288-EWTN. That's 1-833-288-3986. Outside North America, call 1-205-271-2985 or send us an email to openline@ewtn.com.
Hot off the presses from EWTN Publishing. No, it's not the Colin Donovan story, not yet. But it's Web of Faith, A Curious Catholic's Answer to Theological Question. Questions by a couple of EWTN favorites, Fathers Ken Briganti and John Trigilio. They've been doing that show, Web of Faith, for quite a while now, and they've kind of taken some of their experiences there and put them into this beautiful book on apologetics, where the two of them will draw on their years of pastoral experience, and they've compiled this comprehensive list of the best questions that have been asked of them, things like how to deal with family collapse, what the church teaches about cremation versus burial, how to avoid the dangers of the internet. So it's really, it's an educational book, an entertaining book, and a good reference book also to have around after the fact. It's Web of Faith, A Curious Catholic's Answers to Theological Questions by Fathers Ken Briganti and John Trigilio, available now at EWTNRC.com. First up today is Kevin in the great state of North Carolina, listening on Sirius XM Channel 130. Kevin, thanks for holding. You are on with Colin Donovan.
Oh, hey, Colin. Thanks for taking the call. Hope you have a great afternoon.
Sure, Kevin. Yeah, I am. What's your question today?
Question for a little bit of a minutia here, but I live in North Carolina, very close to the South Carolina state line. I was raised Catholic and, you know, grew up in the parish environment and kind of looked at your zip code, that's the church you went to, and it was taken very seriously then. Currently in the diocese I'm in now, there really aren't parish lines. There are a lot of parishes close to each other. They basically just want you to go to whichever parish you feel you mm-hmm. fit in. And unfortunately, you know, one of the things that's happened over time is, you know, every parish has a very different flavor that you attend Mass at. But the question's come up now. There's a parish in South Carolina that we've been attending Mass to, and they have a lot of North Carolina families that register there. And I've done a lot of research about registering, and I know that's typically an American thing and so forth, and lots of other parts of the world don't do it. But I guess the thing that's made me uneasy is as I did the research, people had mentioned on some of the websites that you really can't cross the local ordinary. So you need to stay within the diocese you live, particularly now, because, you know, sometimes there's a dispensation for Mass, sometimes there's not, and so forth. Mm-hmm. So right. I was just trying to get a feel for, is there any guidance now about, you know, in my current diocese, they don't really have a parish boundary anymore, but they really expect you to stay within the diocese. But if I live in North Carolina, I want to go 5 miles into South Carolina, it's a 10-minute drive.
Sure,
can
sure,
I register for a parish that really...
I get the outlines of the question. Well, you can and you can't. The can part is you can go to Mass at any parish you want to, any Catholic rite, Latin rite, or Eastern rite. So in terms of just Mass attendance, I would say there's serious canonical issues with the idea of registering. You are a subject of the bishop in the diocese in which you reside. And there are different kinds of residents, different kinds of quasi-residents, and so on. They're spelled out in canon law. But those would assume temporary conditions. You know, you're traveling to another diocese, you're there for 6 months, and you have to do certain things ecclesiastically. How will you be treated? Obviously, you can, you know, you can do that with respect to your local diocese and so on. So I think from the canonical point of view, it's difficult with regard to registering, not with regard to going to Mass and receiving the sacraments. That's a different matter. And the reason, of course, is the hierarchical nature of the church, that the Pope is over all the church. He has given to different men the task of shepherding a certain portion of the people of God, and those are his responsibility. So from that point of view, there's a good theological reason for that in terms of the unity of the church and the order within the church. And so from that point of view, I would say you don't want to register, and it's really not appropriate to do it. The other part of it is that as a Catholic, you know, it's easy as Americans to sort of be church shopping, and you're looking for the parish you like, and everybody does that. In most dioceses, you're a member, resident of a particular parish, but, you know, if you belong to if you have a more traditional bent, you can go to the more traditional parish and even be permitted to register there, because you're under the bishop, and so that's up to the tolerance of the bishop and the tolerance of pastors. And if that tolerance is there, then there is no problem. But I think going across the diocesan boundaries, unless the bishops themselves manifest, you know, a willingness to permit that. And then there's the other questions too, the very practical questions of participation in the life of the parish, support for the parish, support for the priest who has charge of particular portion of the people of God in that parish. So then there are those very practical things in terms of our duties as Catholics to support the church. Now, you can obviously give money to other entities. People give money to EWTN, or they give money to Catholic Answers or other apostolates. And they do that without, you know, surrendering their obligation, as it were, to give, to support the parish and the place in which they live, the charitable works, the care of the pastor and the physical facilities and so on. So I think it all flows from sort of a theological conception of the nature of the church and how, as individual Catholics in our faith, we should fit into that and respond to that by an active participation in the life of the local church.
833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number, 833-288-3986. Next up is Gary in Jackson, Michigan. He's listening on the Amazon Echo. Gary, you are on with Colin Donovan.
Okay, great. Thanks for your great programming. I just had a couple questions on cardinals. The first was John Henry Cardinal Newman. Was he ever a bishop, or was he only ordained a priest?
Michael, could you pot Colin up? Well, have we lost Colin's audio? Once again, 833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number. We're efforting to get Colin's.
I'm back.
There's Colin's back.
I potted myself down effectively.
Oh, well, very good, Colin. Nice job. I appreciate that. You get the gist of Gary's question here? What? Cardinal Newman?
Regarding Newman and cardinals in general. No, I don't recall off the top of my head whether he was, he certainly was a priest. I don't recall that he was a bishop, as a convert late in life who was, you know, attracted by the continuity of the church back to the beginning, back to the apostles. But no, the individuals that the Pope chooses to be cardinals do not have to be bishops. They do not have to be priests. They do not even have to be lay men. And so there is some talk today of whether the Pope might, you know, appoint a woman to that role. It's a role of advice and counsel, and it's a role of being a papal lector. So basically, it's whatever the Pope makes the law to be. The popes make the law as to who can be cardinals. Historically, there have been lay cardinals. There have been abuses of that, the appointment of nephews and children and things like that, young non-adult people to be cardinals and so on. But generally, I think it's taken very seriously by the popes. But nonetheless, his supreme authority extends to how, whom, and how cardinals will relate to him in their capacity as cardinals. Being a cardinal doesn't necessarily therefore mean you can celebrate the sacraments if you're not a priest. Orders still applies in all the other ordinary ways in which it applies.
Does that help, Gary?
Well, that actually answered my second question, because I wondered if canonically if there's anything to prevent a layperson from being a papal elective.
No, they have been and they could be. That'll be up to the popes.
Yeah, very
present
good.
And future.
Yeah, thank you, Gary. 833-288-EWTN, 833-288-3986. Next up is Sandy, stuck in traffic in Montgomery, Alabama. Sandy, listening on Sirius XM 130, you're on with Colin Donovan.
Oh, thank you so much. I'll pass a little bit of the time right now. I'm enjoying your program.
thank you.
I'm wondering, I have a friend who's an atheist, and invariably we're going to get in an argument at some point because it just kind of wants to situate me in a situation that I don't like being in. So how do I defend my existence that I believe in God against an atheist?
Sure. Well, one thing you have to realize is belief in a supreme being, belief in God, does not require faith. For over 3,000 years or more, certainly going back to the Greek philosophers 2,300 or 2,400 years ago, it was considered possible to draw reasoned conclusions about the existence of God. And so Aristotle did. We don't know whether he was familiar with the revelation to Moses. It's interesting that many of the things he said in the 320s and earlier before Christ coincide with God's revelation to Moses, specifically on the point of existence, that God identified himself to Moses as I am who am. So a full 1,000 years before rational thinkers, I presume an atheist considers themselves a rational thinker, a rational thinker named Aristotle determined that views of creation coming about spontaneously or by some kind of an infinite series made no sense, but rather that for all of the causation that existed in the universe, there had to be a uncaused cause, in other words, a first cause. In other words, if we speak in the terms of science today, for example, and many people who believe themselves to be atheists have just assumed that religion and science are in contradiction, that faith and science are in contradiction. This is simply totally false. Science is a moving target, and any scientist can tell you this, because if it's based on theories and hypotheses and evidences, then it can change at any time. There have been a number of revolutions in science already in the last 100 and 200 years, revolutions in astronomy, revolutions in geology, revolutions in other disciplines as well. Simply because as newer insights have gained, scientists revise their theories and their explanations. After the break, we can continue and address a couple of these at least. But I think this is the first barrier, that religion and faith are incompatible with science.
It's Open Line Friday with Colin Donovan.
This is Open Line on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number, 833-288-3986. A couple of open phone lines and plenty of time for your calls. We're talking to
Sandy.
Sandy, that's right. Sandy, that's who's right. Stuck in traffic in Montgomery, okay. Alabama, so we're helping her pass the time by discussing how she can talk to her atheist friend about her beliefs.
Right, and I think the main obstacle is people consider today very often consider that religion and faith is contraindicated by science and rationality, that no rational person would believe in God. Now, you can further define that in terms of Christ and the church and all of that, but that's unnecessary. You got to believe in God before you can believe in Moses and Christ and the other things. So let's start there. So 2,300-400 years ago, rational men, philosophers in Greece, determined that the explanations of an infinite series of universes and causes and so on was not a satisfactory explanation for all that is, that there had to be a first cause. This is a term by Aristotle. He had no understanding of the God of Moses. He may have heard of this God, but Moses has been told the same thing by God, that his name was I Am Who Am. That was God's name. In other words, philosophers in the church today see this as a statement of God being a self-existing being, a self-existing cause. Now, science has gone through many permutations. Rationality has gone through these as well. It's something of a moving target based on the way we approach science and reason. But here's the trouble. There tends to be one only endpoint, the choice between God and not God. And I would take the modern example of what is reputedly the second Einstein of recent centuries, and that's Stephen Hawking. A brilliant astronomer, mathematically figuring out many of the difficult problems of cosmology. And so, eschewing any kind of idea of God, he concluded that what caused the universe essentially was itself. In other words, he displaced God with a self-causing, self-existing universe. This is where we all end up, because the notion that you can go back beyond the Big Bang, for example, and you can say that, well, there was nothing there, and all of a sudden there is something, that really doesn't make any sense. You're back where Aristotle put us 2,300 years ago. So eventually every generation of thinkers will get to this point. How do you explain that which is? And you'll either have faith in a God who enters our human history with the Jewish people and through Christ, and through whom people experience a personal relationship, or you end up creating a God out of the material universe. And that puts us back where the pagans were. Because if the universe is self-creating, then the universe, you could say, is, well, in some fashion, God. Well, there are movements in the world today that speak of God as Gaia. Or I can think of Pachamama and the whole debate over that somehow we personalize the universe, we personalize creation. Mother Earth becomes a goddess, and so on. So are we actually making any improvement by looking to nature? Is that any more rational than saying that there is one supreme God who created everything, who is the cause of everything, who interacts with that creation down through history, for whom we have a record of that interaction with the Jewish people and the miracles associated with that interaction, with Christ and the miracles associated with Christ, the resurrection, and with Christians in the church today, and we see the miracles continuing where laws of nature are defied in the miracles of the saints. So what you need to convince her of, first of all, is it's not a legitimate question to dismiss God and to dismiss religion and to dismiss the church based on there being some more rational explanation in science today, and then we do not need that. Because we're in essence have gone back to the way we were before Christ. in having a very pantheistic view of the world in which nature itself is all important. And the effect of that is that human beings become simply a cog in that nature. And there are a lot of consequences to that as well. So I think there's a number of arguments there that you can start with, but I would approach the rational and science argument first, because I think that's where most people's hang-ups on religion begin.
833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number. A couple of open lines for you at 833-288-3986. Next up is Betty in the great state of Virginia. She's driving to North Carolina, listening to us on the EWTN app. Thanks for tuning in, Betty. You're on the air.
You're welcome. Thank you for taking my call, and thank you
You're
for
welcome.
Doing this program. My question is, I'm returning from a family funeral of my sister, and we are from a long-range Irish Catholic family, and she was her husband is not a Catholic. Anyway, she was 88 going on 89. He's almost 90. The priest gave him the Eucharist during the Mass. And you had mentioned earlier, Colin, regarding canon law. And I'm just wondering, what is that law? Was this all right for this to happen? We were very concerned about it.
Sure. Well, as I noted in the earlier discussion, and that is canon law does describe situations, circumstances of serious need. I would be hard pressed to squeeze those circumstances into the canon law. Hopefully the pastor made a good faith judgment regarding that. But as a general matter, the kind of intercommunion at marriages and funerals, which used to be more common, I think is becoming less common, because not only does canon law discourage it, but the U.S. Bishops' Conference has discouraged it. Missalettes that are published, most Catholics could just pick up the missalette in their pew, and typically on the last page, if it's a soft cover missalette as opposed to a book, we'll have a statement from the Bishops' Conference talking about the norms for receiving Holy Communion, precisely in order to discourage this. In the end, it will come down to the pastor and the judgment that he made. So I think in that context, yes, certainly it raises questions, but then on the other hand, he could have determined that there was some serious need. We don't even know that whether or not this was a regular practice or anything. So I'm going to pass on making any judgment on that situation. But yes, normally weddings and funerals are not meant to be open communion opportunities. The husband of the deceased, with the agreement and dispensation of the pastor, perhaps that I could see as a potential circumstance. But even that requires belief in the Eucharist, being in the state of grace, and meeting the other conditions that the canon law provides. So we can't know whether those were met or not, and that is the difficulty in saying, yes, this was or was not a case that met the law.
Next up is Jim in Cincinnati, Ohio, listening to EWTN Radio today. Jim, you're on with Colin Donovan.
Well, thank you very much for taking the call. I appreciate it. First of all, great job. God bless both of you. This is a complicated issue, but I tried to put it as succinctly as I could. I'm addressing this to the United States in particular. Does the Catholic Church acknowledge what is generally referred to as illegal immigration? And if they do, and they consider this a problem, what is their solution?
Okay. The church has teachings on this. The teachings are twofold. Pope Francis has said the same thing. Our bishops' conference has said the same thing. The Catechism, I don't know if it's addressed specifically, it's that succinctly, but it would say the same thing. And that is, on the one hand, there is the obligation of charity and mercy to those whose circumstances ask us for it or beg us for it. So, for example, your neighboring country has had an earthquake, it's had other natural disasters, it has a civil war or whatever it is, and people show up on the borders. That requires charity and mercy to them. It doesn't mean, you know, this far and no farther. If you die on the other side of this line, then we don't care about that. No, so there has to be the mercy and the charity there in the case of people seeking legitimately seeking assistance. On the other hand, the Pope has said, and the Church teaches, that states have the right, nation states have the right to set their borders, to set the laws which control immigration in a controlled manner, to set those rules, knowing that, yes, there will be exceptions. And most nations have laws. I know our United States does. It has laws about refugees. It has laws about other circumstances, political asylum, and so on. All of those are the mercy and charity kinds of exceptions that there ought to be. The debate is not on whether these two views are right or wrong. They're both right. But the question is how to reconcile the practical issues. And that's not the function of the bishops' conference. That's not the function of the church. That's the function of politics. And so politicians have to grapple with that. And I think we rightly take, you know, shots at them for being too hard one way or too hard the other way. I think, frankly, that many politicians who probably on the side that I vote on, are maybe not generous enough in this respect. On the other hand, the idea of open borders and free access, regardless of considerations of the ability to handle it and to ensure its fairness, to ensure the safety of people, also is wrong. So the question is, we're governed by faith, hope, and charity. We're governed by justice and prudence, and all of these things come into play, but governments and politicians must make these decisions in accordance with those moral obligations. They don't always do it. We have a problem now with the so-called crisis, real for some and not real for others on the border, as during the last administration. In part because everybody's looking for political gain and not for the good of individuals, the good of the citizens who are here, the good of citizens who are afraid about criminality, about drug traffic, gun trafficking, child trafficking, other potential aspects of this. And so if everything is about making political hay, nothing gets done. And sadly, in this country, we've had about 25 or 30 years or more of nothing being done by both parties. And I think it's a scandal. But it's not the church's job to give the politicians a solution. It's the politicians' job to come up with prudent solutions that respect all of the, some cases, competing values that are at work in this problem. And that's true of every other problem we face as a country, the problem of crime in the streets or foreign wars or whatever it is. All of those things have moral values that need to be applied, and they're not always applied. And that's, you know, if the church were to propose, well, here's the solution for immigration, or here's the solution for economics, or here's the solution other than to teach. That's the church's job, to teach. Teach the gospel, teach morality, teach moral values, and then for people to live and act in accordance with those and make their judgments as politicians, as voters, as citizens, as whatever role they have in the society.
833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number. Still time for your calls at 833-288-3986. Amelia is in San Antonio, Texas, listening on Guadalupe Radio. Amelia, thanks for holding. Welcome to the program.
Hello. I have two questions. My first question is, what is grace?
What is grace?
Do you want me to give you a second one? Yes.
Well, the first question, grace. Grace is God enabling us to do different things, to believe, to hope, to love, to be chaste, to be strong and courageous, to be prudent. So we give names to all of those things. We call them by names of virtue or whatever it is. But it's basically that we are, with the help of God, doing something. And that's what grace does. It helps us do something in a holy and orderly way in keeping with God's law and will.
Okay. And my second question is, I work with children, and we went to the library, and I let them take out books by themselves. And we were reading a book, and it had on there, let's talk about families, and it had on there, some families have two moms and two dads, and the little boy asked me, well, how is that possible? And I was like, I didn't really know how to answer him, because I don't know their beliefs, their views. But I know mine.
Well, you know, it's not a matter of belief. It's a matter of biology. And it's not possible for a child to have two moms or two dads. And so that's now, maybe those children aren't old enough to have been given the facts of life. But that would, at an appropriate age, there is a time to explain that. And the fact that nature has determined how parentage comes about. That would be one aspect of it. Now, socially, we are in the process of warping nature out of recognition from itself. And one way is two moms and two dads, to suggest that somehow, two women and two men can provide a child with the nurturing that would otherwise be given them by a mom and a dad. And sure, practically speaking, if somebody's parent dies and two sisters or two brothers raise the child, sure, you make the do with what life deals you. But we're not talking about that. We're talking about self-chosen situations. And it's an unfortunate characteristic of our society that reason and nature is being thrown out for feelings and for, what I want to do individually, without respect sometimes for the good of the children involved.
Thanks, Amelia. We appreciate that phone call. Next up is Buddy in Ozark, Missouri, listening to EWTN on Covenant Radio. Buddy, you're on with Colin Donovan.
Yeah, thanks so much. Hey, could I get a comment from you about dualism versus monism or oneness?
Mm-hmm. Well, the idea of monism, start with dualism, because it doesn't make sense, at least from the Christian perspective, without that. Dualism is the view that essentially there's a good God and a bad God. And so everything is divided into good and evil. A real warping of that occurred in the early church with some of the early heresies that taking this point of view, they discouraged, for instance, they discouraged marriage. They discouraged anything that was of a material quality simply because in order to be spiritual, you had to set these things aside. And so that was an early error that the church dealt with. And it's not that the church didn't want people to be spiritual, but rather that often this led to the worst kinds of moral behavior. Because if the body doesn't matter, then I can do anything in the body and it doesn't affect me as a person. I'm a good person. Doesn't matter what I do in my body with any kind of sin or behavior, because I'm a good person and the body really doesn't matter. That's mine to use and abuse as I want. That was one of the sad results of the dualistic view. Now, monism, which is not a term that is certainly used in the church regarding itself, you would say would be the monotheistic view, the view of the Jewish people and the view of the Christian people, that there is one God, that there is no evil being. But there are beings created good, the devil, and human beings who follow him in his path. There are beings who created good by their freedom of choice do evil, moral evil. And so that's the explanation for evil in the world that Christianity has adopted, that there is only one God, that he is all good, all holy, that everything that he created is good, as we're told in the book of Genesis, and that the evil that is in the world, material and spiritual, is the work of those personal beings, angels and men, who have chosen to do what is contrary to nature, moral evil. If nature is good, then the things which accord with nature are good. Marriage and family and sexuality and food and work and all the other things that make up our natural lives. But that's the view. And then if you do something contrary to that, then that's a moral evil. If there is material evils in the world of storms and violence and so on, those are going to be either material evils resulting from fallen nature or will be moral evils resulting from fallen human nature. So that's the language of monism and dualism really only applies in the context, I think, of, you know, philosophically dividing the view that everything is monolithically good or monolithically evil, I suppose you could say, and that there is both good and evil and they are both existing. The church would say that evil is a lack of the good. It's not a thing in and of itself.
Thanks, buddy.
I don't know if that helped.
Yeah, we appreciate the call. Very quickly, we'll head to Alex in Panama City, Florida, listening on the iHeartRadio app. Alex, just a couple minutes left with Colin Donovan. What's your question today?
Hopefully it's a quick question. Credo Catholic, my wife is a devout fundamentalist. She believes women should be pastors, whereas I do not. And besides, you know, Timothy saying, you know, women are not to be teach. And what is a good way to represent our standing on that?
Sure. The Father created the universe outside of himself. We are reflected. Our masculine nature reflects creation outside of itself. The feminine nature, the goddesses and Gaias of the universe, of the religious world, reflect a view of God creating inside himself, or creating herself in that case, or creating of herself. So the distinction between the male and the female there has to do with the way God revealed himself as creating outside of himself, which is an analogy. We are analogous to that as males. Christ is an image of the Father. He became man. He established the priesthood, the episcopacy, and the diaconate to image him in his imaging of God. And so that's what a sacrament is. It's an image of an unseen reality that teaches us about that unseen reality. And so here, the sacramentality of the priesthood means that if we have women priests, we are accepting the legitimacy of goddesses, that God has not properly revealed himself as creating outside himself. And so this is where feminism and Catholicism parts ways.
Does that help, Alex?
Roger that. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. We appreciate the phone call. Colin, we are just about flat out of time. As always, we appreciate you being so gracious with your time.
Happy to do it.
I enjoyed it so much. Let's do it next week.
Okay, let's do that. I'll plan my time.
Terrific.
Well, we, away again.
Yeah, we thank you so much for tuning in to EWTN's Open Line. We do the program every Monday through Friday at 3 Eastern Time. We have an encore at 9 p.m. Eastern Time here on EWTN Radio. On behalf of our host, Colin Donovan, our producer, Michael McCall, and our call screener and social media maven, Mr. Jeff Burson, I'm Jack Williams. Thanks so much for tuning in today. Back at it again on Monday, Father John Trigilio is in the house. We'll talk faith, family, and fellowship on Tuesday with Father Wade Menezes. Father Mitch invades the space on Wednesday, talking church teaching and the like. Father Dominican Father Brian Milady on Thursday, and Colin brings up the caboose again on Friday next week. So until we get together on Monday, have a great weekend and God bless.